Welcome to Vox Talks Economics, recorded live at the Paris School of Economics CEPR Policy Forum 2025. My name is Tim Phillips and, I'm at the Paris School of Economics, where the conference sessions are just beginning.
You know, CEPR is a network of economists, mostly based in Europe.
This year, the forum is organized around three themes: artificial intelligence and labor reallocation, working conditions and remote work, and inequality in the workplace. In short, what's work going to look like in the future? So, let's start with artificial intelligence. David Autor of MIT gave the keynote address. In contrast with many of his colleagues and co-authors, such as Darren Acemoglu, he has an optimistic attitude to the benefits that AI might bring to the workplace, seeing it as potentially an antidote to the labor market's turmoil of recent decades in the US. When I caught up with him, I asked him, first of all, if he thought the popular vision of AI as the end of work, articulated amongst others by Geoffrey Hinton, the godfather of AI, and Elon Musk, was overblown.
I think AI is an amazing tool that has great potential. And we should recognize that it opens a range of possibilities from pretty good to pretty bad. And if you say, you know, could AI be used to improve healthcare and make it cheaper and more accessible to more people? Could it be used to improve education? Could we use it to advance the way we generate energy, to make agriculture more efficient, even, you know, direct traffic more effectively? I think you'd have to say, well, the answer is, of course, yes, it could be used that way. If you said, could we use it to make more powerful weapons? Could we use it for more disinformation? Could we use it for more invasive monitoring and surveillance? Yes, the answer is yes. Which do you think will happen? Well, your statement about that is not a statement about AI. It's a statement about your belief about human institutions. That is the fundamental question. How will we handle this opportunity, this tool that we have? And then when you ask yourself that question, it's hard, at least for me, not to think, gee, is this the optimal moment for this to arrive? Wouldn't we have handled this better, actually, if it happened in 1970 or 1960, when our institutions of democratic governance and global governance were stronger? And I think that's my main concern. But I would say one should be simultaneously optimistic and pessimistic, because some of all of those things will happen. You know, we will make some terrible mistakes. Some people will do some terrible things, and some jobs and roles and occupations will be displaced in the labor market. And then on the other hand, we will also make these big advances, and we'll also create new opportunities. And so even if the average is good, even if it's above zero, almost no one will experience the average.
Yeah.
Right. And so the distributional consequences will inevitably be mixed. I think one should be humble in forecasting, but recognize there's an enormous opportunity and risk.
When we're thinking about how we handle it, especially in the job market, a lot of people in North America and Europe, they will be thinking about recent experiences with automation, which didn't work out well for a lot of people. And they'll be thinking, okay, the AI is going to take my job away, make it possible to outsource my job. So are they kind of interpreting AI as a sort of a similar force to the things that have helped to destroy jobs in the past? This helps to think about this as a sort of a doom technology.
Well, I wouldn't say the last wave of technology was a doom technology. I would say that it was mixed.
Yes.
Right. It was actually great for people who do professional and technical and managerial work, right? It, it made them more effective. It eliminated a lot of the repetitive tasks. And it's helped expand that sector of the economy. We have more high-skilled jobs than we ever have. The problem was it displaced a lot of people from the middle, from office clerical, administrative support, and production, and operative positions. And they were doing more expert work, and now they're doing less expert work. They're doing food service, cleaning, security, entertainment, recreation. It's socially valuable work, no slight to it, but it's poorly paid because it's not credentialed or specialized. Most people can do it in the very short run. And so the question for me is, will AI, one scenario is it just decontents a lot of work. It makes it so that everyone can do it, and therefore it's just not well paid and everyone's interchangeable. The alternative is it enables more people to do valuable specialized work. They get like table stakes for doing software development or medical care of some types or law. You can get in more effectively because you have better tools. So that's the question. Will we augment expertise or will we just automate it away?
Right. And this is your concept of mass expertise, which we're going to talk a little bit about in a second.
In 2023, we spoke to David's colleague at MIT and frequent co-author, Daron Acemoglu, about the path of technology and how we can shape it. You can find the episode called Power and Progress from June of that year.
Much of the time we cover work in Vox Talks, we thought about AI as some human capital is going to be automated away. Let's see what's left at the end of it. You have a slightly different view on it. Well, probably a completely different view on it, talking about the value of expertise. So first of all, define expertise for me.
Yeah, great. Thanks for asking. So expertise means the domain-specific knowledge or competency to do some practical and valuable thing, right? Could be bake a loaf of bread, code an app, diagnose a patient, design a kitchen, repair a water heater. And expertise is the basis of labor value in industrialized countries where such a small part of work is just physical work. But expertise, its value can change quickly, and not all expertise is valuable, right? So you need two things for it to be valuable. One is it's got to accomplish something that people value, right? So it's got to be, you know, data science, not card tricks. And the other thing is it needs to be scarce, because if everyone is expert, no one is expert. And so it's actually very dynamic. What is expert in one period is not necessarily expert in another. Or we all of a sudden need a form of expertise that we didn't previously have because we have a new tool. I like to use the word expertise rather than education or skill, because education is static, right? You complete your years of school and you have the same education for the rest of your life. But that doesn't mean the value of the skills that you have or expertise is static. Moreover, there's lots of ways to gain expertise. People who do, you know, hands-on work, people who do or work in the trades and so on, they have tons of expertise, but it's not acquired through schooling. And the way that automation or AI interacts with that is really contingent. In some cases, it eliminates the kind of rote, repetitive part of your job and makes you more effective at the thing you're really good at. Right, allows you to do medical diagnostics more effectively, to write a better legal brief, to, you know, design a kitchen better. In some cases, it takes away your expert work and just leaves you with residual. And then it may be productive, but it's not good for the workers. I take the example of a checkout cashiers at a grocery store. They're much more productive than they used to be, right? Because they scan stuff, they don't have to handle money, their throughput is so much higher. Their wages aren't rising, right? There's minimum wage jobs. And why is that? Well, it's because it's inexpert work. Arguably, they were more expert, you know, 40 years ago when they actually had to be able to make change and they had to be able to memorize things.
Yeah.
And so the work that I've done recently with Neil Thompson, among others, Neil Thompson, my colleague at MIT in the Future Tech Group at the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab, we sort of asked this question about how expertise changes as automation proceeds. And the starting point for this is that the notion that jobs are not just single tasks or bundles of tasks, and they're bundled together for a reason, right? There's a reason, like, why does everybody have to do their own receipts for travel?
Yeah.
Right? It's just too hard to outsource that. Or, you know, why do professors both research and teach? Or, you know, why do people who write legal briefs also meet with clients? And so when you automate some task, there's other parts of the bundle that remain. And so you should care about what part of the bundle is being done by the machine and what part remains for you. If the task that is being automated away is a supporting task, an inexpert task, it's your receipt management, well, that's just going to allow you to concentrate your labor more effectively in your comparative advantage. On the other hand, if the thing that it automates is the thing that you did that was really valuable, well, then, in some sense, it's eroding your comparative advantage. And workers recognize this, right? This is not just an academic idea, right? So my colleague John Horton gave me this great example. You know, his family runs a big construction firm. And when you make walls, concrete walls, you put rebar in them, reinforcement bar. And that's a pretty standard activity. But there's one part of rebar wall building that's actually very skilled, which is called the tying of the rebar ends after they come out of the top of the concrete. And that takes know-how. But now there's a machine you can buy, a rebar tying gun for like $2,000 at Home Depot. And it does that. Workers hate it. And the unions try very hard not to allow it to be used on worksites matches. Now, why do they hate it? They have lots of tools that they love, right? They wouldn't think of going somewhere without a jackhammer, their power drill, pneumatic hammer, steam shovel. You wouldn't want to use a hand shovel. Why do they hate this tool? Well, it's because it's devaluing a form of expertise that they have. They recognize it. It's not collaborating with them. It's competing with them. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the kind of double-edged sword. And so what we show in that work is that you can look at what has been taken away and what's been added and look at jobs that become more and less expert. And as they become more expert, you know, wages tend to rise, but employment doesn't rise that much because you've actually made the job harder. As they become less expert, wages don't tend to rise, but employment rises because more people enter. And just like a very concrete example, it's not exactly technology, but like Uber caused this massive influx of people into taxi and chauffeur driving. Wages in that occupation did not rise, at least in the US. They fell relative to the average, but there was a 240% increase in employment. So it's actually kind of a mixed picture. Automating the same task can have different implications for different occupations.
Yeah.
So, you know, like an example, I have a wonderful administrative assistant, and for two decades, she's been editing my papers and letters. But now on weekends, I take my reference letters and I give them to Claude. And Claude is really quite a good editor. It's a terrible writer, but it's a good editor. For me, this is like a force multiplier. I can just do this even faster. I can do it on the weekend. I do it late at night, whatever. And so I feel more effective. But it's actually taking away an expert task from her, right? So it's actually decontenting her work. And so the same act of automation has a bifurcating effect on the two of us.
It's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? That if you take away some of the expertise in a job, then employment in that job goes up. That's not really our mental model of what happens in the labor market.
That's right. And, you know, you obviously can automate something out of existence. Telephone operators, we really don't have them anymore. Everything they did was automated.
Yeah.
But often there's a residual task, right? If I'm a UPS driver now, I don't have to do route planning, right? That was the most expert part of my work. I still need to drive and I still need to bring boxes to doors. The job exists, but one set of tasks have been taken away, and arguably the more expert tasks. I don't have a greater theory about what makes a bundle persist. That's something I'm working on. But I think in many cases, the tools are very, very far from completely replacing. And I think this is a mistake that computer scientists make all the time, or Jeffrey Hinton, when he said, you know, we won't need radiologists 5 years from now because obviously the software will eliminate them. 10 years after he made that prediction, we have too few radiologists and they're overworked, they're burning out, they're making a lot of money. And why is that? Well, they use AI all the time. Like, it's super useful to them. But reading scans is just a part of what they do. And now they actually can process more scans, more effectively looking at more diagnoses. And they spend a lot of time coordinating care and talking with other experts and specialists. There's a mistake to think that automating one piece of something is the whole thing. This is a conceit. And AI invites this hubris, right? Well, of course, it's superhuman. So everything it does, it will displace people.
This framework that you have is very interesting and it's very innovative, but can you test it empirically?
So that's what we try to do in that paper. The first thing we do is we show how to measure expertise of work by using, I don't want to go into too much detail, but we use a tool called the efficient coding hypothesis. It originates in perceptual biology, and now it's in information processing, information theory, but it allows you to identify expert words. Expert words are words that are infrequently used and have low entropy, meaning you can predict their origin conditional on hearing them. So if I use the word elasticity, you say, oh, that guy's an economist. But if I use the word incisive, right, that's not a common word, but it has no obvious origin. You couldn't say, oh, that guy is a journalist or that person is a philosopher or whatever. So you can identify expert words, and that's helpful for classifying jobs. And then we look at tasks added and removed empirically. We measure their expertise and look at how the expertise of jobs changes. We are using data from 1980 to 2018. The jobs become less expert because of tasks being removed or tasks added, right? So a job can become less expert either because you remove expert tasks or you add inexpert tasks. Those jobs see relative wage declines, but their employment grows. And jobs that become more expert, they see relative wage increases, but their employment grows more slowly. And you can do this either with task removal or task addition. The change in the bundle of expertise really is predictive and not in the direction you think. It's not like more expert, more wages, more employment. It's just the opposite. More wages, not more employment, it's harder. And so automation does reduce barriers to entry. You know, no one in America knows how to drive a standard transmission anymore. You know, you don't have to know that to drive a car, which arguably was one of the hardest parts about driving a car. And we also do a further test of this. So that's a kind of a correlation. But in the final part of the paper, we say, okay, well, let's look at routine task prevalence within occupations. And we know those are going to be eliminated, right? Over the next 40 years, a lot of them will be automated away. Let's take each occupation and measure the change in expertise in that occupation if notionally all the routine tasks were removed. This actually bifurcates occupations because for some occupations, the routine tasks were just the supporting tasks. And for others, they were the expert tasks. And we show that just as this tiny little conceptual framework predicts, occupations that became more expert because routine tasks were predicted to be removed got higher wages and shrank. and occupations that became less expert as a result of routine task removal, again, using the prediction part, their wages fell, but their employment relatively grew. Even the elimination of routine tasks, which is something people have talked about for a long time, bifurcated the expertise distribution of a set of occupations. They didn't all shrink and have falling wages. Some shrank and had rising wages. Others grew and had falling wages.
Central to this is the idea that we think of occupations as a static frame.
That's right.
But they are changing all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And in interesting ways, right? So being a medical doctor arguably gets more complicated all the time. Being an auto mechanic may have become less complicated over time because you have tools that do so much of the diagnostic work, right? And your job is much less problem solving and much more physical manipulation. And yeah, like being a London taxi driver, right? They spend 3 years memorizing all these. That expertise is no longer scarce, right? It's encoded in your phone.
So David, let's circle back to where we started. What does this imply for a path of adoption of AI that would do the least damage to our work?
Let me actually bring in a related idea, which is that how AI is designed is a choice of obviously the people making it, the people who are adopting it, even the people individually using it. And I think you can think of it as in two different ways. There's two different types of tools. Roughly, you can group tools into two buckets. These don't have to be even size buckets. One are what I call automation tools. These are tools that take something that was formerly expert and do the whole thing. A dishwasher, automatic transmission, elevator operator, the toll taker on the highway, right? Those used to be jobs and now they're fully mechanized. And that's great, right? If you can do that, more power to you. Like, I don't want to wait in line for a toll. I'd just rather have a machine do it. Most things aren't simple enough to automate. And so most other tools are what I call collaboration tools. They're tools in which you have to bring some expertise to the table, right? So a stethoscope, good for doctor, useless to me. Chainsaw, good for some, dangerous for most. And many tools, the table stakes is you have to know something and then the tool is helpful to you. So a collaboration tool is a force multiplier for expertise. An automation tool is something that eliminates expertise. That's not a value judgment. Many things we'd like to automate them if we could. However, in many cases, we don't actually know how to automate things. And the hubris in the AI era is we do. Everything can be automated. And it just turns out not to be true. And the problem with that not being true is bad automation tools are bad collaboration tools. They're not helpful to us, right? So an automation tool needs to be successful almost 100% of the time to be useful, right? Like if the automatic transmission on your car decided it wasn't going to shift 10% of the time, you just wouldn't want that. Or if the autopilot on a plane stops being an autopilot at the crucial moment, that's a really bad automation tool. A collaboration tool doesn't need to be good 100% of the time, right? You don't expect your stethoscope to solve or diagnose all medical problems, but it's still useful to you because in some sense, the ultimate responsibility and expertise lies with the person, not with the tool. What that means though is you can't just say, well, we'll just automate. If it doesn't work, we'll collaborate. You really need a different design if you're going to do that. And so I think a lot of AI is being designed to automate and not very effectively. And in the end, people end up collaborating with it, but not that effectively. Partly it's what is the mindset when they're being built and how are they tested, right? Most AI is tested against basically lab benchmarks, against a data set. Well, you're not going to learn anything about how it collaborates if you do it that way. That's a closed process. But when they're actually deployed in the real world, you often get very different results. You know, people are using them. People are fallible. The machine is fallible. And how do they talk to one another, right, to figure that out? When two experts disagree about something, like let's say, you know, you and I are looking at x-ray and I say, I think it's pulmonary embolism. You say, I think it's bronchitis. I can say, well, look, don't you see this? And you say, well, no, you're missing that. We might reach a diagnosis that neither of us thought of by collaborating over it. But you can't have that with a machine that just says, do this, do that. There's not an opportunity. It really goes to the philosophy of how you're building these things. And the false expectation that everything can be automated leads to substandard tools that are not as helpful to workers. They're potentially more dangerous to users, like the Tesla autopilot, good example of that. Communicating that back to the tool builders, I think is quite important. I'll say I'm a Google Technology and Society Visiting Fellow. I'm there one day a week, virtually there. My work is all around expertise and trying to learn about tools that basically enable people to deploy expertise more effectively and acquire it more efficiently. And that is the mission. And I feel like AI is a tool that can be used collaboratively to enhance the value of expertise, but I don't think that's often the goal.
Yeah, it's very alluring within firms to be able to say, this fixes this immediate problem, which I think—
And saves money right away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is there a path from that to the vision that you have?
I think the path is often that the first approach doesn't work. And so they have to regroup. I think there's a huge tendency to overclaim, and then you have to recalibrate. But of course, that seems like a very wasteful path. Part of it is, how do you benchmark these things? And if you just benchmark them in the lab, you're going to get a very misleading result of how good it is. And so you need actually to say, well, let's try this tool in a setting with people, how it will be used, and how does that work out? And I think that steers you much more naturally towards tools that don't try to eliminate all human expertise, but expect to work in collaboration with people. It's not that the tools aren't great. Tools give us superhuman capabilities. I can see things with a microscope that I could never see with my eye. I can fly an airplane. I don't know how to fly otherwise. So tools make us superhuman, but that doesn't mean they automate everything. Actually, most valuable tools are the ones that allow us to do things that we could never do before, not just make the old things better, cheaper, faster.
You wrote that AI employed wisely in the labor market can help rebuild the middle class. How does it do that?
And that's kind of a best case scenario, not a prediction. It's a possibility. The idea would be the inverse of the process we've undergone for the last 40 years, where people have been moving to inexpert jobs as their expertise has been displaced. So much of the valuable work in contemporary economies is expert work, it's decision-making work. If it didn't require decision-making and judgment, it would be automated already. Guilds of experts monopolize modern economies, right? Whether they're professors or lawyers or software engineers or architects or medical professionals, right? They're expensive. They're not getting much more productive, and everybody needs them, right? We all spend so much money on healthcare and education. A good scenario for AI is that it would lower the barriers to entry by enabling more people with the right training and judgment to do a larger set of care tasks, of legal tasks, of software tasks, of education tasks. It's not to say that everybody could do it. That's not what I mean at all. But like a nurse practitioner, a registered nurse in the United States, an additional year of education, does diagnostic and prescription tasks, treatment tasks that were previously only in the domain of medical doctors 20 years ago. And that's a huge advance. And they're supported by technology in doing that. It's not why it happened, but they rely deeply on electronic medical records, on diagnostic tools, on software that looks for drug interactions. And so the net result is you don't have to have the additional 5 years of medical training to do this very valuable work. Software development will be less technical in the future, but perhaps more people will do it. Everyone says, well, you know, no, software development is dying. You know, all the coders are all being eliminated. Maybe that's true. But think about 25 years ago, when all of a sudden everyone in the world suddenly discovered they needed a website, right? Creating a website was a technical activity. You write stuff in HTML, not very complicated, but you needed a programmer to do it. And those websites were horrible. Now, website coding is non-technical. It's mostly about design. It's a different set of people doing it. It's a very skilled activity, but it's not skilled because the back end software of it is that complicated, the plumbing. What makes it skilled is the design elements. And so a different group of people are doing website development. They're not the people who are the, you know, HTML coders of another era. The good scenario, if we use AI well, would be to enable more people who are not the educated elites. Like in the US, you know, only 4 in 10 workers has a 4-year college degree, enable them to do more valuable expert judgmental work. That would be the good scenario. And I think it's possible. It's not guaranteed at all. And that's a design choice, right? How can we make tools or design aspiration to enable, say, look, we're going to collaborate with people who know something about medicine, know something about law, know something about software. And with better tools, they will be able to go further with that knowledge.
It's an institutional choice as well, isn't it? Because there are many institutions for whom this does not represent a good option.
Yeah. Look, I think that our professional guilds are set up to prevent people from doing this, right? So the American Medical Association has fought against nurse practitioners in the United States since their inception in the 1960s. They don't want to loosen their scope of practice boundaries. Everyone wants to monopolize the valuable work. And in the US, you know, we have tons and tons of occupational licensure. To be an interior decorator in Florida, you need a license. Why is that? It's because you want to protect your turf. And so people are very concerned about tools that create more competition. But the good scenario is one where actually where people enabled by AIs are able to compete more effectively with the kind of people at the commanding heights. I mean, those professions have done great over the last 45 years. Now it's time to let someone else have a chance, especially because we're all dependent upon them. It's easy for me to like being a professional. I'm expensive. I get paid very adequately. And so I can afford to pay for the education for my kids and the healthcare for my kids. And I'm like, well, I'll take that deal, right? Because I'm on the winning side of that when I get paid, and I'm on the losing side of that when I pay others. But if I'm driving a bus or if I'm working in a restaurant, I'm not on the winning side of that. I'm just on the losing side, right? That stuff's getting more and more expensive. So I would like to see a world in which more people could do that valuable work, enabled by better tools. You know, I can do things in a wood shop with a saw and with a miter and, you know, that I used to take a lot more skill. It's not the case that all elimination of expertise is a negative, because it does lower barriers to entry.
How long do we have for this adjustment? Do we get to see out our careers and it happens to the next generation, or is there going to be a sort of a mass realignment of the workforce?
It's happening already. The question is how fast. It's really hard to predict. I think that this will go much more slowly than AI labs are predicting, for two reasons. One reason is there's a huge time difference between invention and widespread scaling and adoption. So let's say autonomous vehicles were mastered, you know, tomorrow morning, right? It would still take 25 years for the fleet of vehicles to change over, right? You're not just going to throw away all your existing trucks and say, well, we're done with those. There's a huge capital investment. And so these transitions always actually occur over long periods of time. And this would be true, like even if we had artificial general intelligence, you know, we would still have nurses 25 years from now. I actually think that it takes a very long time to re-engineer the way we do anything for that process to have a big effect. And this has always been true. The internet did have a big effect, but it took 20 years for it to be really noticeable. A lot of the technologies that are transforming what we do today came online a decade or two ago. The second thing is, I don't actually think the technology is advancing as rapidly as is said. It's getting better in narrow ways, and it's great. Like, this is not a knock on technology. AI is wonderful. If it never advanced again, it'd still be incredibly useful to us. But there are multiple ways in which I do not think it's converging towards artificial general intelligence. I don't think there's any evidence we're on that glide path. It's getting better, but it's fundamentally missing things. It's deeply unreliable. These, quote, scaling laws of AI have already broken down. And I think we don't appreciate how complex the problems are that we're solving all the time, and how much of our intelligence is about synthesizing a very large number of factors and inputs to make the right decision in a way that, you know, most AI is extremely context blind. Again, that's not a dig on the technology. I think it's great. I use it all the time. I want it to advance. I just don't think we're headed towards an employment apocalypse at present. I don't want to minimize the risk. It's real. Right now, you know, lots of coders are being displaced. I wouldn't want to be a language translator. I would not want to be an illustrator. There are certainly activities and roles and occupations that are vulnerable, but I don't think most are. I don't think it's going to be like the China shock. It will not have the same geographic concentration. It'll be productive, not just lower prices, but higher output. And if we get better at a lot of these things simultaneously, that will generate productivity. If we actually got so productive in medicine that we needed fewer people doing it, that would not be good for those medical workers. But there would be a lot of societal benefits of a cheaper, more efficient healthcare system that provided more services, that could extend its reach into other countries and help people maintain better health for longer. We should be optimistic and pessimistic simultaneously. We should be cognizant of the risks and the downsides and never think that everybody benefits. But recognize there's really good things that could come from it. And if you really believe it's going to displace a lot of work, in general, you probably believe it's going to be really productive. And if it's really productive, that will have other benefits as well.
David, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
The paper is called Expertise by David Otor and Neil Thompson.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, how good are large language models at doing our jobs?